I'ma say what I feel, and I promise to keep it real.
Welcome to the Red Room. So you wanna be a rider, well you gotta be a rider till your fears are diminishing, the doubts are behind ya. It's hard to grind and the business got me stressed in the rant room. We let that shit up off our chest. You never have to guess when you're listening to Hilliard. He gon' bring more game than a shark playing billiards. It's all about the craft of screenwriting. It's exciting when you turn an outline into something enlightening. Your pen and words are like bullets in a gun. Write what you feel, say what you want. Welcome to the rant room.
What's up, y'all? It's your boy, Hilliard Guest, and you guys are listening to the Screenwriters Rant Room, where we keep it real, we keep it opinionated, we keep what Rich? Game all day. Yeah, on this show, we discuss entertainment, TV, film, music, culture, but our focus is always screenwriting, stories, craft, and shit like that. You can curse on the show, Zadok.
See
that? Zadok, indeed. Be yourself, be yourself. So if you guys are grown, we're going to jump into the show. Just so you know, my man Renee Rodriguez Lopez might jump in a minute and join us on the mic. For now, it's me and Zadok talking shit. Here we go. What's happening? We got my man Zadok Angel in the building. You guys have seen him out there. Every time he turn around, he on the cover of Deadline. You know what I'm saying? Like as if he got it going on at Echo Lake. Y'all ain't doing nothing over there.
We've been busy.
He ain't got no job. He ain't doing nothing. Anyway, welcome to the show, my old friend Zadok Angel. Y'all, what's happening, my man?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Indeed, indeed.
I was trying to remember on the drive over because you and I have known each other for
it's
years.
It's been a minute.
So long that I was trying to remember when we first met. Was it when it was when I was at Paradigm?
Yes,
right?
You were at Paradigm. Yes.
And were you going? Were on Heroes then?
I
was the show you were working on at the time.
I think I met through. I think Ron Taylor introduced us, if I recall.
Okay. Oh, God bless Ron.
And then
Ron.
Paris Barkley connected me with him. So yes, it was like this
Paris
whole
was
little...
a very important client of the agency at that time.
For sure.
And, you know, Paris connects everybody. Indeed. But I remember meeting you back then, mm-hmm. and it's just great to see all that you built and accomplished, and 400 episodes of a podcast everyone listens to, and all the work you're doing at Amazon. It's really fantastic. I've seen some of the journey from afar.
See, he watching the brother. He know what's going on. Yeah, man. It's been a... here he is. Come on in, Renee. I'm going to put you on the mic, Jack.
Okay.
I kind of already introduced him a little bit. Renee Rodriguez Lopez over there working at BET Plus. What's happening, man? How are you?
Welcome. I'm good. Sorry I'm late.
You all right? You all right?
Was dealing with a fire drill. Good to meet everybody.
Right. He pretended like he got a job, too. He ain't got no job. He ain't doing that.
Hi, Renee. Good to meet you.
Say, Dr. Angel.
Hi.
Indeed. We were just starting. He was just reminding everybody about how we met each other almost 20 years ago, it seems
probably.
Like.
Probably. It was quite a while. Exactly. I was still maybe a baby agent.
You might have been like
time.
A junior agent at the time or something. I don't even know.
Yeah.
You probably were just around, in between.
Probably around 2007, I want to say.
It was right before the strike.
Yes.
It was literally, yes.
Okay. It so was it was before 2007. The strike.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've been through two strikes now.
Crazy.
Got our stripes.
Yes, indeed. So I was telling him, you know, we were talking about how he got here. But I was going to ask you, let's go back and just tell everybody like where you're from and how did you get into the game at all?
Well, there's something I love better in entertainment than origin stories. And I love to tell my origin story, and it's something that actually we talk about a lot at Echo Lake, making sure our clients know how to tell their origin stories. Mm-hmm. So that when they're in meetings, they're talking in an interesting fashion about their own lives.
Right.
We talk to our fellow managers about that. You know, when you're in a meeting with someone, anybody, you know, you want to know their story. I'm lucky because I think I have a pretty unusual path to Hollywood. I grew up on a dairy farm in rural upstate New York.
400 acres, chilling. Look at that.
400 acre farm and a family operation. So my grandfather and my mom's dad founded it. And then my parents took over when they got married. And it's what your I think everyone's ideal of a family farm is, we knew the names of our cows. It was probably 200 head of cattle. Right. It was my grandparents, my uncles, my sister and I every day getting up and, you know, taking care of these animals in the family farm. Mm-hmm. And it was this, you know, wonderful agrarian childhood that I didn't fit into at all. I did not belong.
Why is that?
I was this overweight, creative, gay kid. Didn't know I was gay at the time. But I was, you know, stuck in the middle of nowhere. Right. I always say it's kind of like the 19th century or something I was born into. My parents were not only full-time dairy farmers, but they also had part-time jobs outside of it. My mother was the local Methodist minister in town.
Oh, my God.
And my dad was a local politician. And so I grew up steeped in agriculture and politics and religion, and there I am, like, drawing and painting and writing. And I was telling my mom at the age of 5 I wanted to be an artist. And I was very lucky because my parents believed in they had a New England sense of individualism, and they felt that their kids should be individuals and that we should stand on our own 2 feet. And so they always said, whatever you kids want to do in your lives, we'll support you. Okay. And I like to say I bit them in the ass. Like, they had no idea what that would mean and how it would play out. My sister's a scientist who lives in Juneau, Alaska, is raising her family up there. I thought I was going far by escaping to Los Angeles to pursue entertainment. I mean, we got off that farm. Had no intention of running the family farm. But it gave me and my sister this incredible farmer work ethic, which is the thing that translated to Hollywood. You know, all of us, we have to work so hard in this business. Mm-hmm. You have to be so ambitious, so driven, often for no money, because you love it. You love the work. You love what you're doing. You're passionate about it. And believe it or not, farmers tend to be really passionate about what they do. Mm-hmm. They love to work outside. They love to work with animals or machinery. They're not getting rich. They're not really getting ahead in life. They're doing it because they love it. And so that carried through. It just threw me in a way that was very, very, very different. Mm-hmm. So I knew from an early age that I was creative and that I was really interested in television. I loved my favorite TV shows. At 3 and 4, it was Scooby-Doo. At 5, it became He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. Yes. And
I have that, the power.
Exactly. We all know it. That show probably is the thing that changed my whole life. Mm-hmm. I just loved it so much, and I was a very loyal fan. Mm. So I had to watch every episode, and I had to buy all the toys, and I was a collector, so I collected the stories and the toys. And so you can see at 5 and 6, I'm loving TV. I'm loving ongoing characters. I'm caring about this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was doing my own illustrated storybooks for He-Man episodes.
Can you draw?
Yeah. Okay. I was drawing and illustrating. And I was basically writing spec episodes of my favorite TV show.
Oh, really?
As a 5 and 6-year-old.
Oh, wow.
I just love that. Mm. And so, and that just kind of stayed with me as I got older and evolved. You know, by the time I was in middle school, high school, I was watching live action, primetime network dramas and comedies and getting much more into live action sort of stuff. But I would seek out screenwriting magazines from the Barnes & Noble in Syracuse, New York, an hour's drive away. And
Wait. You couldn't go online back then?
You couldn't? No, not really.
You couldn't just click Google or something?
And there were companies back then that would advertise in these magazines, and you could buy produced scripts for shows. And they would be the Marigold draft that someone had thrown into a trash can on a lot, and somehow these companies would get it and they charge you $35 a pop or whatever it was to get a copy of it. But I would pore over those scripts so I could see script writing format and how it would work. And at that time, that was kind of the first big wave of David E. Kelly shows. And so I loved Picket Fences and Ally McBeal and Practice. And so I was writing spec scripts of Picket Fences as a high school student. And the only person I could give them to who cared was my high school English teacher, Darcy Smith. And she would read them and give notes. And I mean, I remember vividly as a 10th and an 11th grader, watching the Emmys and really caring about who won. And the only person I could talk to about it was my English teacher. Nobody, the other kids didn't care. No one else was interested. But I had the TV bug bad. And I was subscribing to Entertainment Weekly and TV Guide. I cared about the fall preview issue every year of TV Guide and what were the new shows going to be. And I would pore over that. And I knew the schedule of the broadcast networks. And you know, this is a farm kid. He doesn't have access to much, guys. We had, I think, NBC, ABC, and CBS. We had three channels and like an antenna getting us our TV channels. And I was so jealous of the kids in town who had cable and they got to watch cartoons on weekdays. I was so jealous of that. But it was very clear I was into television and storytelling and cared about these things. But I was doing it from this rural town. The town I grew up in is South Otselic, New York. It is technically, I believe, a hamlet. The entire school, K through 12, has 500 students.
Wow.
So I had a graduating class of 33 in a public high school. I mean, this is country.
Wow.
The town is so small, there's no stoplight. It's a blink and you miss it kind of town. And most of the kids, you know, will stay in the community. They'll get a job after high school. They'll go into the military or like a local college, community college. There's not much opportunity. It's a really economically depressed area. And there I am being this like artsy gay kid doing theaters and watching my favorite TV shows and wanting to talk to somebody, anybody about the Emmy Awards. And but it was some part of me knew somewhere out there was this world where people do this for a living. And I mean, I was the kid who would write letters to the editor of my favorite comic books and magazines. And once in a while, the letter would get published.
Really?
And it was such a thrill. It was like, oh my God. Because it was a connection to that outside world, you know, here in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
That people were out there. But no one was around me telling me, you can do this, or there are people who do this for a living, and you know, that kind of thing. That's why the emergence of screenwriting magazines in the mid to late 90s was so important, because it showed you that people do this, and here's what a script looks like. And David E. Kelley was kind of a star showrunner, and he was writing all his scripts on yellow pads that his secretary would type up. But even that writers could be you know, names like that and famous was kind of a newer thing back then. And now, you know, everyone wants to be a famous showrunner, but that was a pretty nascent thing back then. I imagine Hollywood pre-90s was an incredibly closed off community. Like you literally had to live here to have any access. But anyway, I did my creative stuff on the side, but I was also really strong academically. I worked really hard at school. I'm sure part of that was being a closeted gay kid who didn't realize it, you know, that perfectionism to overcompensate for this, all the reasons people won't really accept you or really like you for who you are. And but that perfectionism served some purposes. You know, I was a straight A kid. I worked really hard. I was always a teacher's pet, and, you know, ended up marrying a teacher. Like, I have family who are teachers. I love teachers. But that served me well, and I got into Harvard undergrad, and that transformed my life. I went from this super sheltered country farm childhood in the middle of nowhere to living in Cambridge in the middle of a city with a subway. And, you know, I was a, kind of a big fish in this tiny pond. And then you go to the school where people, everyone's a valedictorian, people are rocket scientists, people are geniuses. And you spend all of freshman year thinking, I must be the mistake. How did they let me in here?
Imposter syndrome.
Absolutely. Exactly. We didn't even have that phrase back then. What it is. And I'm not the only one who goes through that at that school. Lots of people kind of have to work through that and then move on with their lives and do their school and extracurriculars and whatnot. But it definitely opened me up to like the world. And that was a huge transition. I thought I was going to be an English major. And then kind of realized freshman year that Harvard has a very small arts department. At that time, it was called the Department of Visual and Environmental Studies, which is a terrible name for an arts degree. They finally have revised it, but it
can you steal the new degree. Can you steal the new title now?
It's like arts and I actually haven't committed it to memory. I'm embarrassed. It's only in the last, I think, 4 years they've shifted it. But it sounds more like an arts degree,
right,
as it should. But there were different tracks you could do. Art photography or sculpture, animation, film video. I, of course, did film video. And you know, people would expect that school of all places to have a film program that's just theory-based. Yeah. But it's actually not. It's all production-based.
Really?
I was making films on 16mm, editing on an old-school Steenbeck and Seaver basement in the dark for hours and hours and hours. We were shooting films on video. I took only three theory classes the whole time in my degree. So I love that I was able to get that experience of making films and doing those things, and it taught me so much about storytelling and the power of editing and cuts and all the 100 million choices you know, directors make when they're putting together a film and trying to tell a story, and you know, got a lot out of that program. I spent my summers in college doing internships in Los Angeles. I really felt the need. I've got to get out there 3,000 miles away from anyone I ever have known to see if this will work, if it's real. Yeah. And for some reason, even though I grew up in upstate New York, I kind of knew in my gut that New York City was not the place to be, that that Hollywood existed in Los Angeles, and that I really needed to get out there. And lots of people I know take
If theater was where you're going, you probably would have.
There is some film and TV in New York City, of course, but something just told me that that wasn't where I needed to be. My instincts were strong about that. And I have a lot of friends who took 5 or 10 extra years to figure that out and then moved out to LA. You know, we all have our own journey.
Exactly.
But I spent I did 5 internships in 2 summers here at a variety of places. It was like, what, the Bold and the Beautiful, the CBS TV City lot, which, you know, is still going. Malcolm in the Middle. I was in the an intern in the writer's room there one summer. I also did Carsey Werner Productions, which was still producing hit multi-camera sitcoms at the
time.
They
were huge.
And it was a real window into what the last gasp of when Hollywood shows could be owned by individuals and local people running their own studios. And, you know, they had a kitchen where they fed all their employees for free every day at lunch. And there's a real cost that all the profits now go to corporations and shareholders instead of local people making TV and movies. And I got a little taste of that there. I've worked at Buna Murray in reality television, and that was a good window into that. It's all storytelling at the end of the day. And I interned in the story department there, but that was eye-opening. But I knew reality wasn't where my heart was. You know, it was always with writers and scripts and development. So I did all the Edzwick Herskovitz, Edzwick and Marshall Herskovitz Company, Bedford Falls. I interned there. They were in pre-production on The Last Samurai, which, you know, was a Tom Cruise movie in the early 2000s. So it was a big deal. And they tasked their really smart intern from Harvard to shred photocopies of the script and all the artwork and the things that they were planning, because people were literally going through their trash to try to piece together what was going on with a new Tom Cruise movie. So that was you know, just interesting, and they're all great humans who worked at that company. So I knew by the end of my college years that I wanted to be here. I did like Los Angeles. I was excited to go, and so as I was nearing graduation, I really I felt very lucky, because so many people senior year are stumbling around in the dark going, I have no idea what I want to do. And I knew I wanted to do entertainment. I knew I belonged here. I didn't know exactly what role that would be, but I had my kind of North Star, and that was incredibly comforting and compelling. Those instincts at that time of my life were really strong. But college, those years helped me figure out a bit where I belonged in the entertainment industry. You know, I went through the phase where I thought I was a writer, and I tried writing classes, and I thought I was a director, and I was directing short films. I produced a number of theater shows on campus. I produced other people's films. And by the end of senior year, it was becoming clearer and clearer that where people really embraced me was in the role of producer, where I was really good with people, I had good taste, I was organized, I could make things happen. Those are skills that a producer has, and that, you know, I learned later on, representatives have. And so that's, college helped me figure that out. You know, I think it didn't work out as a writer because I could not fight the blinking cursor. I mean, it is so hard what you do. It is really, really hard. Yeah. And I think creative people have to be incredibly patient with themselves. Mm-hmm. You have to waste an entire weekend to write that bad draft of that script that nobody's going to read, mm-hmm. but you got to mm-hmm. get out of your system so that you can get to the good script you're going to write next, mm-hmm. you know? And that's very hard to do. You have to be patient with yourself. You have to be kind with yourself. You have to spend the time to work on your craft and get better and know that it may not add up to anything quantifiable, right. you know? And that was very hard for me. I'm a very goal-oriented person. I like to be busy. I like to do a lot of things. I like to accomplish. Mm. And that's great to have in your representative. Yeah. Not so great if you're a writer and you're just, you know, kicking yourself constantly because you haven't written the next brilliant screenplay. And so college was, again, useful in figuring that out about myself.
And so you pivoted? Is that what I'm hearing? In college?
Yes. You. And I came out. I had a girlfriend to give it an old try. I learned a lot in college. And I feel like because I had such a sheltered childhood, my adolescence, I feel like, happened in college. You know, mm-hmm. I had a lot of growing up to do beyond learning how to live in a big city and beyond mm-hmm. the world and whatnot. But by the end of school, it was clear I needed to be in L.A. So I moved out here.
When did you move out? What year?
2003, summer.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So I've just passed my 20th anniversary of being in Los Angeles.
Oh, congrats.
Kind of worked out, you know? I'm very proud of that.
Still look like you're 16, don't you? Little.
I'll take it.
You're a vampire. We know you're a vampire.
Yeah. You have all the secrets, sir, to the fountain of youth. But anyway, I moved out here, and ironically, I was really trying not to work at agencies.
Oh, really?
I didn't. Mm. I'd heard all the horror stories from...
Especially back then. It was... Ooh.
Yeah, this was Entourage era Hollywood. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the agencies were infamous for screamers and yellers and people throwing things at you. Mm-hmm. And my roommate, one summer out here, was finishing up his last months at CAA working for a screamer, and you know, he had a terrible experience.
Really? Sound familiar, Tyler?
Yeah. And he ended up being, his name's Alex, he ended up being a writer on Family Guy, and he has been for years and is incredibly successful.
Yeah, definitely.
But at the time, he was just grinding it out. And talk about the discipline you need to have to be a writer. He devoted himself, and every morning, I think he was up at 4 or 5 a.m. writing an hour or two before going to his awful job at CAA to work for this awful human being so he could pay his dues to become somebody in the business. And he, you know, that was an example of, okay, the sacrifice we all have to make to be in this industry. So anyway, I was avoiding agencies, and then I got a job at Buna Murray working as a logger. So
what's that?
At least at the time, these reality shows like The Real World and Road Rules, mm-hmm. you know, they just shoot tons and tons of footage, and they need people to actually watch them. Mm-hmm. So they would hire people like me to watch the footage and record what was happening on these tapes every 30 seconds to a minute. And then you tried to flag exciting moments or dramatic moments or that kind of thing. And then your reports would go to the story department that would start to sort out storylines and character moments mm-hmm. and try to shape episodes out of what's coming from the raw footage. But they need people to actually put eyes on all this footage, right? So I was able to be
it's like a different version of reading the transcripts. It's like you're watching the transcripts instead of reading.
Exactly, and you're transcribing what's happening and you know, trying to communicate what the story is. So I did that for, I don't know, it might have been 6 weeks or something. Mm-hmm. But I'd moved out here. I was unemployed, no job. You know, I had my relationships I had made from my internships mm-hmm. and through those relationships had gotten roommates and was staying as one of five roommates in a five-bedroom house in West Hollywood and living that experience. And so I had a place to live, but I didn't have a job. And but because I had done the internship at Buna Murray, they liked me and they hired me. And I started working as a night logger from I think it was 6 to 2 in the mornings.
Wow.
But it allowed me to keep looking for a regular job during the day. Oh, okay. And eventually, I was looking at the UTA job list, and there was a posting for a boutique literary agency. And I thought, well, I know I like writers. I like development, literary. they're boutiques, so maybe they're not monsters like the biggest places. I'll try. So I sent in my resume and they interviewed me, and you know, the irony is that the person that they were firing at the time, he was working for two of the partners who both did TV Lit, representing TV writers and directors. They
welcome to Hollywood. You hear the ghetto bird out there and everybody, the cops and shit.
Yeah, yeah. Should let that pass. They'd hired a career assistant who like overdid the whole job and had an Excel document for every phone call and
no cheat sheet.
This guy was just drowning, and so we want the opposite. We want young, hungry, and they're not gonna, I guess, overcomplicate things. So you know, I got the job, and I was working for two of the partners in TV Lit, and I'll tell a, I think a funny anecdote. I'm deaf in my right ear.
Oh really?
And so I was terrified that my, you know, disability, I would even call it that, but that this was going to hold me back in Hollywood.
Right.
And when you're working for two agents and you're supposed to field calls and shouting from both of them, you need two ears. And so I would have, you know, my headpiece in one, the good ear, and then not hear anything out of the deaf ear. Man. And so, you know, they would constantly, you know, shout things to me that I would not really hear, and then I'd get up from my desk and I'd go to their doors and I would say, you know, I'm sorry I didn't hear you, what did you say? And then, you know, get it right and get it done. And I think they would still tell you today I was a very good assistant, very on top of it, and very hardworking, and that farmer work ethic paid off. But it took me a year before I confessed to them my secret,
really?
That I was deaf in one ear. That's hilarious. They laughed. They were like, you're incredible. Like, well, that would have never been a problem. What are you talking about? But it wasn't a problem after I'd proven myself. But I think all of us do that a little bit because you're so afraid that one little thing might prevent you from your dreams and your success. Right. And that was one of my little things. I also had to choose to be out as a gay person in that job. And there was a minute when I started where I thought, you know, this is a very professional, buttoned-up environment. Maybe I should hide that. But I had done the work of coming out to everybody I knew after my sophomore year of college. And I thought, well, that's being dishonest and disingenuous, and it is a people business, and I did choose to be my authentic self. And at that age, your authentic self was frosted tips, and I literally had a rainbow tie I would wear to work, and, you know, they knew. But that was a choice I made, and in 2003, it wasn't the obvious choice to make. But I'm glad I did, and I'm glad I didn't play any games with myself where I tried to hide it.
I used to have this thing where, and sometimes I'll interject, sometimes I'll just listen. But
please.
I used to have this thing where when I was an actor, I noticed early on I'd be at an audition or something or whatever, and I'd be talking to the director or whatever, and I would throw away the fact that I was gay. So I'd be like, yeah, you know, I'm from here, blah, blah, I'm a gay kid, who, blah, blah. I just throw it away. But I found I was doing that so that I already told you. So that there was no, I didn't know he was whatever, or
right.
Or I would know then how you were going to work with me once you found out who I was. But I threw it away. I didn't put a hat on it. I didn't do it. I just threw it away, and then I just kind of kept going about my business.
That's so, you know, smart. I mean? Yeah, it wasn't like a big coming out moment every time.
Exactly.
Yeah. And your attitude towards it kind of communicated to them how they should treat it, right?
It's just, yeah.
Who I am, not a big deal. Moving on.
Yeah. I'm cool with it. If you ain't, I can go. You know what I mean? Yeah. But go ahead. Keep
in. Absolutely. So about a year into my time at Paradigm, or at the company was called Genesis. It was a boutique literary agency.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then Paradigm, you know, bigger agency we all know, bought that company around 2004.
Oh, they acquired it.
And so I went from, I specifically chosen a boutique literary agency.
That's hilarious.
Small, hands-on, da-da-da. And then we became part of a bigger place. And at the time, Paradigm was a mid-sized agency, and they were buying other mid-sized agencies like Genesis and Writers and Artists, and they started acquiring some music agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And we all kind of came together one August weekend in 2004 in a new building, and all of a sudden you have these new colleagues and new culture. And so I chose to stay there and be committed to that company. And I wanted, I love that there was a path to promotion and advancement. That was the Harvard Kid in me very much loved that. And I'm like, okay, if I work really hard as an assistant, I can get promoted and be a coordinator for the literary department. And then if I'm a great coordinator, I can get promoted and be an agent. And that is a ladder of achievement I can tackle. And so that's what I did. I worked really hard to step up and go above and beyond and, you know, be the eager, you know, beaver, and did get promoted to coordinator, which is an incredibly hard job. Any of you listening who've been a coordinator.
What's the job of a coordinator?
You basically go from having one boss to the entire department, where like you'll have 13 bosses or however many agents are in that department are your bosses, and you're in charge of all the lists, the grids, the information, and organizing all that information for the agency.
We never have this kind of. It is crazy with the. What are you, Rich? What is it? He can't turn it off. It's okay. Boy, it's crazy out there, isn't it?
I know.
It's 4:30. Interesting. It's 5 o'clock. All right. Keep going. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's just going to be background. Welcome to Hollywood, y'all.
All good. So anyway, as a coordinator, it's a big job. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you know, agencies, their whole stock and trade was information and having all the info of what's going on around town, and which shows are staffing, and where are the jobs, and who's hiring. And now it's a little bit more egalitarian and accessible because of the internet. I mean, we had the internet then, obviously, but it wasn't. The agencies really controlled the flow of information in Hollywood, and that allowed them to get their clients access and opportunities. And so it was really important what I was doing to funnel all that information, have it organized, and I was in every meeting and took notes in every meeting and created action notes out of every single one so the agents would follow up and do all the things they said they would do. And but it was great. I had access to all the agent meetings, and when we'd bring in other companies and meet with them, I would be part of that. So it gave me a window into all the executives around town and at studios, networks, production companies, and it was great for access. So I worked really hard at that job, got promoted to agent in 2007, and about around 4 months
time
later,
we met.
Met Hilliard, and then there was a writer's strike. It was, they clearly didn't think it was going to happen, otherwise I don't think they would have been promoting some young agents. But they did, and, you know, that experience was, you know, tough because I was the new kid on the block, and so the whole time you're thinking, they're going to fire me, they're going to fire me. I don't know what it's going to do.
I just got here.
You barely have any clients. You can't make money. You don't have a track record of making the company money. You're really trading on their goodwill to keep you around. And I think I had a good amount of goodwill, but at that period, I got to hand Sam Gores a lot of credit. He kept all the employees on payroll at Paradigm through that strike, unlike other companies. So we all got through that really tough time, and then I was able to build my career and start signing writers and building people and joining teams for other people's clients and working, you know, really hard at that. About 3.5 years into being an agent, I knew I was really unhappy. I couldn't quite diagnose why. I loved my clients. I loved creative people. I loved the networking part of my job. I loved doing lunches and dinners and breakfast and pitching my clients to, you know, studio and network executives and producers. I loved the people part of the business. I loved talking on the phone. I loved so much of the job and the selling and the communication were really just second nature to me. Yeah. What I didn't love was big agency culture. And today the phrase is toxic masculinity. We didn't have that phrase. But that's what it was. It was the entourage era of you know, agenting, and Ari Gold was the being exalted as the kind of person you wanted to be. And I didn't want to be that guy at all. I didn't like him. I didn't find him funny. I didn't want to be him. I didn't want to be his friend. Like, I was there to do the work and represent my clients and make their dreams come true and make great television. Like, that's what I wanted to do. And I was there for the work. But that didn't quite fit in with the culture I was in. So I think they always liked me. They always liked my work ethic. They didn't know what to do with me in the ecosystem of Paradigm at the time. So I knew something was off and not working, but not the whole thing. And so I'm very lucky that my friend and now work husband, Dave Brown, who I'd worked with at Genesis, Back, yeah, you met
I'm telling Dave you said work husband.
Yeah, of course. He's straight, by the way.
That's why I was saying I'm making it.
He's very happily married to Jen. But we...
he is cute, though, so it was fun.
We met at my very first job at Genesis. He was a young feature lit agent at the time, and then when Paradigm bought the company, he left and went into management, and then we shared clients with him as the manager and me as the agent. Most significantly, Kira Snyder, who's still one of our signature clients today. Yeah. She's an executive producer from The Handmaid's Tale. Mm-hmm. But at the time, she was a staff writer coming out of the Warner Brothers Writers Workshop and just starting out and getting going. And so he and I were working with her, and we really enjoyed working together. And he had joined a new company called Artists International that doesn't exist anymore. But he had money to hire people, and he could pay me more in salary than Paradigm was paying me to be a fourth-year agent. And so it gave me a safety net to make that transition into management. I was scared. I was terrified. That my only work-life experience as an adult had been 7 years at Paradigm. Yeah. And so I was really afraid to take that risk. And agencies have a habit of making you think if you're not at a major agency, you're off a cliff and no one will ever return your phone call and you're out of the business. And that's the kind of thinking that goes on. So it felt like a giant risk. But if I hadn't taken the risk, my husband was about to push me off that cliff because he knew and Dave Brown knew I needed to go and change my life and do something different. And as soon as I went into management, it was like, a light went on, and I felt like I fit in my job. I fit in my role. I could be the greatest, literary manager in town. Mm. And I felt totally freed from the things that weren't working in my life as an agent. But take all the things I learned how to do, and all the training, and the clients, and do what I do as a manager. Mm. And it was really amazing how fast that transition went and how good it felt right away. And I was very fortunate.
I said, and you can produce now.
True. Yeah, produce, which I've done a little bit of. But bringing the clients in, I was so lucky. Almost everyone who didn't have a manager when I left to become a manager signed with me. And it was
nice.
I'm forever grateful to all of you who stuck by me and made that transition because I had clients I could continue to sell them and get them work and make money and keep my career going. And it ended up being a fortuitous time to switch to literary management because it was kind of before everyone became a manager. And at that time, there were lots of literary agents and not that many literary managers. Today, there's a lot of lit managers and not that many lit agents. Mm-hmm. It's totally flipped. Yeah. But I'm lucky that I made the transition when I did because I clients as they grow
in their careers. It's a real thing. The thing I like about that story for me is how you listen to how you feel. You have your husband telling you one thing, you have your friend, you have Dave telling you something, and you're like, do I make this change? Is it for the better? Is it for the worse? And sometimes you got to take a big risk and you got to risk it all. You know what I mean? And I love those. You got anything you want to jump in?
No, I used to be a high school teacher. So I can't deny the fact that what your high school teacher did for you, you're doing it at a major scale for all your clients. And I love that parallel.
Yeah. I mean, teachers, they make all the difference, right?
Absolutely.
They definitely encourage, in this tiny country bumpkin town of South Otsego, I had great teachers. I was really fortunate. I had the same art teacher from kindergarten through 12th grade. They somehow put on a fall play and a spring musical every year, and they always cast me in the best non-singing role they could find. And the arts were really encouraged, and my writing and English class and literary pursuits, that was all in this tiny town with a 7 through 12 building of 200 students. Mm-hmm. They found ways to encourage our talents. And I'm still close to some of my teachers, and I'm forever grateful. It's really powerful how they can unlock kids and, help them achieve their dreams. It does all start there in school.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think what I've observed is it's really important for you to make people feel important. That's what I've observed in your journey. Why you did not like the toxic masculinity culture. This is not for me. And you jumped into a place where it's important for me to make others feel important. Not just as whimsical as an exercise. You generally do. Because as you said, everyone's got problems. They got to pivot. And you have the advice to give them that.
Yeah, yeah, it's it's important. You got to treat everybody with respect in this town, and you've got to treat, you know, that staff writer is going to be a showrunner hiring people someday.
Yes.
That assistant is going to be a vice president of production someday. And I do think it's one of the pleasures of our business is that you kind of rise up with your generation. And it's so hard when you're in the trenches and starting out. I mean, my coordinator years were dark years where I was just, I was at the office all hours. I wasn't going to the gym. I was putting on weight. I was just giving my all to the agency because I wanted to get promoted so badly, you know? And, which, you know, we could talk about work-life balance, and maybe that was a little bit of an overreach at that time, and I did course correct. But, you know, that's kind of what the business demands of you. But then, you know, you get the promotion, and your friends get promoted, and then all of a sudden, a couple of years later, you're in positions to make TV together. And that was so delightful, and it when you're coming up, it feels like it takes forever, and then when you get there, it's like, oh, that wasn't that long actually.
You said something earlier that made me think that exact thing that you're talking about right now. So you were talking about how when you're in college, you would come to LA and you do the internships at all these different places, and like every job you had actually geared you for the job. If you think back.
Oh, yes.
Whether it's a reality thing or the even logging things, all those things actually add up to be in the positions of what you need to do to be the assistant and all that stuff.
Absolutely. And being a film major and everything. Like
all that.
I mean, I can speak creative to my clients because I at least tried to do it, you know, and have some sense of what they go through in their struggle. And I do think that's important. I think that makes me a sensitive, you know, representative to my clients creatively. But I often tell, you know, interns and whatnot when I do these sorts of Q&As, all of my jobs came out of my first job out here. It's crazy. Like everyone I met at Little Genesis Boutique Literary Agency changed my life. Ian Greenstein hired me to be an assistant and helped get me promoted to agent eventually. And Dave Brown, who was on the feature side at Little Genesis, ended up being my, you know, work partner in crime for building my management business. And you just don't know how these relationships are going to play out in your life. And so it's really important from the get-go to be hardworking and respectful and work well with others and, you know, care about your own reputation and how you conduct yourself, because those people you think might not matter may actually matter a lot to your life long term, and including the other assistants. You know, I networked like crazy with all the other assistants inside my company and outside my company, and that helped me to get to know people all over town very quickly. And I think that's gotten a little lost in the COVID era, but you know, we're always saying to our younger people, you know, go network, go to a mixer, go ask that assistant that you talk to three times a week out to drinks, you know, make sure you're doing that, because it's still a business of human connectivity and relationships. And, you know, networking is such a dirty word, but it's really like having a fun lunch or dinner or coffee with someone and getting to know them and connecting, and could be more fun than that. I mean, it's something I really delight in.
I've gotten 85% of my jobs from other people I knew, not from having, not that my reps can't do anything, but I just happen to already know, and then the thing happened, and then next thing you know, we're signing the contract. You know what I mean? It always happened through whoever it is you know. Let me ask you a quick question. With Echo Lake, with you and Dave, like, what do you guys do that you think that's so special that's had you guys last this long?
Well,
what do you do there in particular that you guys, like, what's your...
Sure. Our style is very much a team-oriented approach. Okay. So every client has two or three managers on their team, and we really believe in that. We all work together. We're hyper-communicative. We have regular meetings where we're all sharing information. A lot of the managers are covering different studios or networks in town and reporting where the jobs are and, you know, finding that information. So it's a teamwork approach. Nice. Like, as soon as we could come back to the office in person, we did, because the team aspect and the collaboration is really they're coming for us.
I don't usually record at this time either, but this is interesting. Yeah,
now we know. But it is that is one thing that distinguishes us, I think. sometimes old school management companies could be kind of siloed, people right. sharing office space, everyone has their own client list and does their own thing. That is the antithesis of how we work. And there's nothing wrong with that other style. That sure. that works for some people. Right. That's just not how we've built our company and our division and our employees. So we all work together. It's very collaborative, very team-oriented. And I think that's to the benefit of our clients because... Right. You know, hundreds and hundreds of TV shows and open writing assignments and feature opportunities. There's just no one person can possibly cover it all or no. know everything. Or, no. you know, you need that field team out there gathering information and reporting back and sharing. And so mm-hmm. that's really important. I, you know, if my client gives me a horror feature, I want to pull in a colleague who sells horror features mm-hmm. to help us do it. Like that's why you have teammates to right. do things, because you can't possibly have it all in one human being. So that's a lot of our philosophy. So we've built a really good group of hardworking, ambitious, you know, caring people who, you know, go the distance for our clients. And it, I think it's made a big difference. And over time, I mean, word has gotten out there and right. We get a lot more incoming queries now than we used to, and established writers who are interested in meeting.
That's because you're on deadline every week. Mm-hmm. That's what you get.
Yeah, yeah. We try, but it's satisfying because it wasn't that way 13 years ago when I started in management. You know, we've definitely built it and grown it, and that's been really satisfying.
Now, when it comes to the producing side of what you guys do over at Echo Lake, do you guys do, is it more like an in-house thing that you liked one of your clients, you know, project and you decided to produce it? Or what's usually the mandate for how you guys produce
it? Yeah, I think Echo Lake's an interesting case study because we're actually the inverse of what most people expect with management and production companies. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, companies start as management companies, and then they eventually decide, hey, it'd be good to produce things, exactly. and they start a production division. We're the opposite. Doug Mankoff founded the company, I guess over 25 years ago now, to make movies independently. Okay. So Echo Lake started as a company to make movies, you know, mostly through an international foreign sales kind of model.
Okay.
And we've done, I think, over 40 movies, you know, in all these years. So that's how the company started. It was to make movies and eventually TV series. And then
is it about doing your clients, or is it something you guys find outside?
The production division are people right. who aren't managers.
Okay.
So Doug himself is not a manager. He runs the company and he oversees a production division that includes right. executives that are like creative executives or like producers. They are building a slate of projects there's a slate of film projects and TV projects, and most of the option books and IP. Yeah. And I would say probably, I think it's maybe half of their projects are with Echo Lake clients, and mm-hmm. half are not. There are people okay. we don't represent outside the company, and that's just because of we didn't happen to represent the right person for that particular project, right? Yeah. And that's the current, you know, status at the beginning of we expanded into management when Mike Marcus joined the company, I think about 18 years ago now. And so he started management, and his experience, he used to run MGM. Before that, he was a feature agent in the Mike okay. Ovitz days. Oh, yeah. So Mike comes from,
I listened to Mike's
movies.
Book. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He's in the book. Mm-hmm. And so they were doing a lot of feature lit for management, mm-hmm. but when Dave and I brought our team to Echo Lake in 2013, it was like expanding the company to also be doing television because we had a really deep understanding of television for right. development and staffing. And so that really kind of blew up and expanded the company. And 6 months before us, Echo Lake had hired talent managers. So we'd started a talent division. Okay. And all that has grown over these, you know, last 11 years to make mm-hmm. it what it is today, a modern right. mid-size management and production company that kind of functions on all levels. Mm-hmm. But it didn't happen overnight.
It's like a little mini studio in its own way.
A bit. And we're really, I know on the production side, they're focused a lot on TV right now. Right. And, you know, we produced The Great, which I'm very proud of, which Hulu had picked up season 4. They didn't. But I would say as far as the managers go, we're very picky about when we produce a client's project. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's always with the client's permission. You have to, if you're interested in producing your client's project, you must have that conversation that you would like to produce. Right. Here's why I'd like to produce. and your client needs to say yay or nay, and it's their choice. You know, I'm not going to hold it against you if you say no. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. fine. But it needs to be open and honest conversation. And in our point of view, it needs to be justified. We should have put the project together or packaged the elements, or maybe Echo Lake had optioned the IP initially. Or there's got to be a reason that we're coming in as producers. And frankly, we don't do it lightly. It's a lot of work to produce. It is not easy. People think it's just free money. It's a lot of hard work and a lot of no's. And, you know, is the person's manager.
See these eyes?
Yeah. It is hard. So I know, when you're representing your client, you're trying to sell their project anyway. And so a lot of the work is the same. But I will say, when I'm producing something, there is an extra layer of investment and vulnerability. Right. When you get the nose on a project that you're also producing, you're a little more hurt.
you're
a little more vulnerable.
Because you're passionate about it. You only choose to do the things that you would really, really get into. Not that you wouldn't represent a script that you wouldn't sell, but there's a difference in how you pitch that one.
Totally. And you have to make sure that if you are producing a client's project, that your relationship is strong enough to go through all the ups and downs of producing a project together, and that you really can do that. You know, I should not be producing all my clients' projects. There's some about that. But that's not why I'm representing people. That's not what I'm in this for.
No, that makes sense.
That has to change the dynamic from just having the relationship with them, just manager and manager and producer.
Yeah, you have to do, they always say the issue is, as a producer, you have to do what's best for the project.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think if you're producing your client's project, a big part of your responsibility is to have your client's back throughout the whole process.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And if there are issues with the network or the studio or whatnot, that you're helping to manage that so that your client's vision is coming through and that they're protected as they go through it. Because, I think it's actually a little harder in features, because so often feature writers get kicked off projects and someone's brilliant idea to get someone else out there to do a rewrite on this person's passion project. In TV, it's not that that doesn't happen in television, but more often people will stick by the initial writer throughout the process, because in theory, it's their vision and they're the creative voice. And it's a long-term relationship in TV versus features. In features, you're trying to shoot one brilliant script and get one movie made. TV, in theory, you're getting into business with a writer for many, many, many episodes. Mm-hmm. So it's a much more of a long-term investment and a writer and their vision. But it's not without its complications. So we try to steer clear of that.
Ever wonder how to bottle up pure excitement, unbridled joy, and limitless potential in a single word? Woohoo! Woohoo Apparel is on a mission to unleash the infectious energy of woohoo onto the world. And they're doing it with undeniable style. I'm talking cool, fun designs made of soft-combed, ring-spun USA premium cotton and 50% polyester, and in sizes from small to extra-large to fit all Woohoo enthusiasts across the globe. Get your t-shirts and apparel at WoohooApparel.com and use the promo code WoohooSRR. That's capital WOOHOO, lowercase SRR. Links in the show notes. Let's talk to the writers who are trying to break in. You're going to get these questions, so I might as well just pose the bloody questions. What type of thing should writers be doing today in this climate, now that we're out of the strike? Like, what's the climate now, and how could they be benefiting themselves today?
Yeah, I think it's, it's tough out there. We all talk about it constantly. Oh, yeah. It's been a really rough post-strike climate. I think, I saw this happen, and you did too, in the 2007-2008 strike. It delays people's careers. People who were on the cusp of getting promoted from assistant to executive had to wait an extra year or two to get that promotion. Yeah. Or I'm so grateful that Paradigm promoted me before that strike. Because if they hadn't, I probably would have had to wait another year or so to get that bump.
Right.
Because it freezes things in time, and it holds back advancement, and you sort of need all the hot, sexy working people to get back at it, mm-hmm. and then eventually the system will loosen up and there'll be more opportunity and advancement. But I would advise patience. You know, it is a really rough time. There is very limited opportunity. If you're really in it to win it, if you really love this business, you're gonna get through it, you know, and just keep moving forward with fortitude and good cheer and optimism and positivity, mm-hmm. because anything negative is just not gonna get you anywhere. Yeah. In my darkest days in my career, I just kept reminding myself, you know, just keep being positive and smile through the hard times and you'll get there. And I think that served me well. I think it helped me stay positive and keep putting one foot in front of the other, even at times where I was really discouraged or really unhappy in my career. And, you know, I think, look, it's even harder for creative people. You're often not getting a paycheck. You're often mm-hmm. alone in your apartment, wondering if your dreams will ever happen. You have to have such strong belief in yourself, in your mm-hmm. talents and dreams to stick it out. And unfortunately, we just went through a boom period where people were kind of advancing more mm-hmm. quickly. Some, not all, but today, you know, today it's just going to be, people are going to be held back for a bit. So be kind and patient to yourself for sure. And keep networking, you know, just keep up the contacts and the relationships and the coffees and the drinks and, mm-hmm. you know, lunches, and because that is a good use of time. I didn't stop doing that stuff during the strike mm-hmm. because for me, that's still a good use of my time, getting to know people I wouldn't know otherwise. I couldn't send them scripts after our lunch, but especially if I hadn't met the person before, at least then I know them, I know their story, we now have a relationship and an open door. Mm-hmm. And then when they can actually do things post-strike, I can come back to them and we can start doing things again. So keep that up. I would also
let me just say, since you just said something about the strike, shout out to Echo Lake. They came through, brought us some treats and stuff out there for the strike, so thank you, Zadok. He came out there himself. Your whole team.
Were very proud to support our writers on strike and actors. Yeah. And I think I saw you. Was it the Juneteenth picket at Paramount? Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I think we did an ice cream truck or something.
It was nice.
But it was great for us to support all of you.
Right.
It also was selfishly fun to get out of the office and feel like you were on the front lines and with your people. Right. And I mean, I just ran into so many writers I represent mm-hmm. and then people I don't represent or used to represent or friends of the business mm-hmm. or it was wonderful.
Right.
Again, I really like the social aspect of this business, and that was great for us. I think we all got a, you know, jazz out of that, even as you all did too. Right. And it was really important to feel that community.
Because I remember back then we used to put up these did you know, all the photographers that were taking photos during that time, there was a photo, because I think you guys had a little like this is donated by, you know, Echo Bain. There was something of that nature, but that made it like on the Writers Guild website.
Oh, I love that.
So yeah. So love we that. Saw it, you know, all of us.
Indeed. Well, and my colleague Dave Brown, this is where Dave is really creative. He's like, we should have hats for the strike and show our support.
That's right.
And then Dave goes down this rabbit hole of like trying to design the perfect hat and try to find the cheapest price on Etsy for a great product. And he spent hours and hours on this, and I was like, you do you. And then he made a great hat.
Did he?
And it was awesome. And then we're all wearing our hats and we're giving them out to people.
Oh, that's right.
Then word got out, and then we were getting requests, and like we just handed them out as catch can or as we saw people on the picket line. And then clients that we hadn't seen on the picket line would say, hey, how come I didn't get a hat? And we're like, oh goodness, what have we started? But I still have those hats. Now they're a artifact of time, which I prefer that to living in the middle of the strike.
Yes,
but we were very proud to do that. And you know, our lifeblood, our creative people, it's writers, actors, directors, the people we represent. Mm-hmm. So how could we not be out there supporting you all? How could we not be fighting the fight with you? I know there were lots of companies that did not show up and did not want to be there, but it was there wasn't even a second thought. All of us, you know, wanted to do that and committed to that very, very early on. And I'm so glad we did.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Were you going to say something?
Can I get a hat? I'm kidding.
I think I have an extra.
I'm kidding.
First dibs to you.
No, it's in the Smithsonian, I get it, of Echo Lake. But, no, that was,
I have a question.
Cool. All right. Yeah. Well, let me just ask some more questions for you, because this is, you know, we deal with writers and stuff. Rich, you got anything you want to throw in?
Yeah.
You want to come up? Just come closer. We can hear you.
Okay. Talk about queer writers, mm-hmm. and especially queer writers who write queer protagonists for TV pilots, for features, and what the chances are of getting those produced. Usually it's the queer sidekick, some amazingly stereotypical character, never the protagonist, never someone who's non-stereotypical. Is there a market for what I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that, I mean, thankfully, the market for queer stories, you know, ballooned over the last decade, mm-hmm. and it finally, we could never tell those stories.
Exactly.
And I mean, I've clients over the years who were closeted and doing everything they could to not let people know that they were queer, and went out of their way not to write gay storylines and queer right. characters because they didn't want to be branded that way. I mean, it was a bad thing, mm-hmm. you know? The same way actors would hide mm-hmm. their identities in order to get cast. And so it's great that that's was turned on its head right. over the last, it wasn't just it since 2020, the last decade, authenticity, diversity, different perspectives was all being valued and embraced. And I mean, being queer didn't count as diverse until recently. It was yeah. like, oh, you're still a white guy or whatever. You know, it's like, right. you don't count. But I think people have finally internalized that, you know, that is a meaningful difference. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you like people of the same gender, or you're non-binary, mm-hmm. or you're trans, or like, well, that's not easy. That's mm-hmm. probably a diverse perspective that yeah. hasn't been traditionally valued. So I love that that's shifted in the business in a big way.
Yeah.
I do think that the contraction period we're in right now, and the push to profitability by Wall Street on top of all these media corporations, has unfortunately launched us into this era of being risk averse and yep. more safe. And so I think that, you know, I'll go out with projects with a queer lead, or like I took out a comedy with a drag queen at the center of it. And the passes you get will be, it's too niche.
Niche
means it's too diverse, it's too black, it's right. too gay, it's too, you know, whatever it is. That's the code word for it. And so I think the challenge is putting queer leads in sort of conventional mediums or genres. You know, what is a queer lead in an action flick, or right. what is a queer lead in a CBS procedural, mm-hmm. or they'll consider that, you know, they'll look at that stuff. But if you're doing, like, you know, Looking on HBO, right. and here's a super slow slice of life, San Francisco, gay folk,
mm-hmm.
No one's looking for that. You know, they need more of a propulsive engine for story. You know, yeah. what's the plot? What is going to happen? Where are these characters going? What are we going to do every week? You really have to guarantee that in your storytelling. So I don't think there's a no on queer stories. It's just putting it into a more conventional venue that is commercial, you know, and that's kind of where we're at right now.
Yeah.
I work primarily in TV. I certainly have lots of clients who write movies, and I give notes on films all the time. But I would imagine it's harder to do queer lead if you're aiming for like a studio film, or, you know, something truly risky. I think if you're really dedicated to that, probably an indie route is going to be more likely. But that's my gut response.
I think that makes a ton of sense. I was just thinking also, one of the other things that Rich and I talk a lot about is, you know, when you're over 50, what's the scenario there? Because he's literally had people, you know, usually some straight cis white male, tell him, somebody over 50, that you can't work on a TV show. You're too old for that. You know, which I think is ridiculous, because I always use the guise of Jane Fonda's, that one show that she did where they staff the show, and she comes into the room and she's like, where's anybody who looks like me? Or
yeah, Lily Tomlin, Grace and Frankie, like, right? Yeah.
So they had to let people go and bring new people in. I was like, he could have wrote that in his sleep. You know what I mean? That type of a show. But that's just one show. And my whole thing is, as somebody who's ran some smaller rooms, I'm like, I'm always looking for the smarter, wiser person. You know, I'd feel it. So I don't understand when people are like, you're already too old to be on set. That's crazy to me.
It's nuts. I think if you're an older writer breaking into the business, it's really trading on your life experiences. Right. You know, what are you, almost like you're a consultant to the show. Like, what are my
superpowers,
personal and, life exactly. experiences that I'm bringing to the table?
Right.
Because you're competing against people who, you know, moved out here after college and all they did was Hollywood, like me.
Right.
Right? But my adult life experience is Hollywood, right? Right? And, you know, you, I'm sure, had other jobs and careers and experiences and family and things and lived in different places that you can bring to the table. And that's where, like, finding that show that needs that perspective, because they're not finding it. And the run-of-the-mill traditional TV writers who have traditional credits and resume is really important.
I'm gonna get more. Totally agree. Yeah.
It's a value, but it's tricky. I think one of the reasons it's hard in TV is that oftentimes showrunners don't want people who are older than them on the staff because it's a seniority thing, right? So it's like you want to staff it with, they want to staff it with younger people who may not be as threatening or, you know, not going to challenge their authority, right? And so it's threading that needle of like, hey, yeah, they might be older than you, but they have a lot to offer that you don't have on this staff.
Mm-hmm.
And really making that argument because older writers do have a lot to offer.
Tyler has a question right quick.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't know.
Closer.
Like this?
Yeah.
Okay. So obviously, I'm guessing the big question anyone's going to have that's an aspiring writer or anything like that when they know that you're going to be on the show is the number one burning question is going to be, what is it that you look for in either a meeting and a person on the page? What is it that you see in someone that you're like, shit, I have to represent this person. I need them under my umbrella.
Good question.
Yes. I think, I mean, look, for particularly for TV writers, it's that combination of, you know, talent and writing on the page and personality and what you're like in the room. And that is, the people who succeed have both.
Right.
And so, you know, the writing is what gets you in the room. Like, if you're emailing me and I'm interested, I'll ask for a sample, I'll ask for material. Make sure to send one or two scripts tops, your absolute favorites. The people who send, here's the, you know, laundry list menu of log lines from which I can choose from.
Right.
It's like, I'm not at a restaurant ordering takeout or something. Like, you know, you know you're writing,
exactly.
Right? You know your best material. You know your strongest scripts. Send me the one or two that all your friends love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is, you know, just an easy mistake not to make, right? And then, you know, if you do get that meeting, it's about your personality and can you talk about yourself in an interesting way? And, you know, can I think if you're having a signing meeting with a representative, you have to understand the first half of the meeting is you selling yourself to those representatives. It's look, we started with my origin story. It's you telling your origin story and who I am and where I came from and why I'm passionate about writing or directing or acting or whatever your thing is and how you came about doing this and the kinds of TV shows and movies you love and, you know, really digging into that so that I'm spending the first half of the meeting listening to you, watching you and thinking, oh, okay, this person knows who they are. This person can sell themselves in a room. I can call executives and producers and get them meetings and they're going to sell themselves once I open that door. And that's essential. And then the second half of that meeting, if you've done it right, is me selling myself to you.
Yep.
Like, hey, let me tell you about me. And this is what I do. And this is what I specialize in. And this is what Echo Lake does. And this is how we work here. And, you know, that means the meeting is going well and we're interested in you and in signing you. But it's a give and take because that's the relationship. Like, you know, you put in a lot, we put in a lot, it's a partnership. So it's really feeling that out. But if you just sit down and say, well, tell me about yourself, or you sell me, or I'm just going to tell you that I'm a professional writer and these are the kinds of scripts I've written and you're not opening yourself
up.
You're not creating the connection. I mean, you just don't know what is going to come up when you tell your story and how we're going to connect and what life experiences I have and what we might have in common. And when I was coming up in the business, when I was really young in the business, some of it was like, God, there's a lot of like just bullshit small talk in this business. And I'd go to lunch with some of the other agents and they just shoot the shit with this executive for,
an hour, and then finally we talk business for the next half hour. And I was like, we got to get to the point here.
Hilarious.
But now I'm very much the guy who will shoot the shit for an hour at lunch and then talk business for that last half, that next half hour. But that's why, because it's the human connection. And mm-hmm. as I have matured in my career, that's so much of the fun of it, you know, is the human connection. Mm-hmm. So you make that in those signing meetings and those moments. And, you know, see, it's being a person and a professional. You know?
I was going to say, to me, that's the part that makes you like them, is when you go, oh, you did that thing? Oh, I like this dude. They did that thing? You know what I mean? That's usually when it connects. It's not just about the work. The work is the work.
Right, and if I read your script and like it already, I'm probably like, okay, that's a talented writer, and I like their writing and vibe with it. And yeah, the other thing I tell people, because keep hitting on them, big on origin stories, mm-hmm. I don't think people always quite realize most of us in Hollywood, like even the business affairs attorneys, have a similar arc of I grew up somewhere that wasn't Hollywood.
Facts.
Had this creative spark in me. I was interested in TV and movies. I had to like leave where I grew up and the people I knew and pursue my dream mm-hmm. and come to Hollywood and do this crazy business and pursue it. And then eventually I figured it out and I worked really hard and I made it. And that arc, that story
right.
is not unique to me, to you, to like we've all lived that.
Yeah.
And so our we have a common story to tell each other, and so naturally we're going to connect, right? Oh, your parents said you couldn't be a writer, and my parents said I couldn't work in Hollywood, and they disapproved, or you know, whatever it is you're connecting on.
Yeah.
That's really common, and so I think by telling your story, you immediately open yourself up to connection. Mm-hmm. And that I think is really powerful. Look, it stinks for me when I meet the person who grew up in Brentwood and went to USC and now they're a film executive right. and you're just like, oh my God, you know, like you have nothing to offer. So I really value doing other things, having lived other experiences, coming from without. And I think most of us in this business, to the surprise of outsiders to the industry, we're all outsiders. We're all dreamers. We're all people who bucked the trend and took a risk and didn't do what was normal.
And even the ones who are from here who you meet are the ones usually who were the ones who were all into TV. They got involved. They did theater. They did. It's just always somebody who's
absolutely.
Like,
and still. Sometimes even if their parents were in the business, they strongly discouraged them or they didn't figure it out until they were out of the nest that they actually did want to do something creative. So there's ways to tell any story, I hope, in an interesting any life story in an interesting way. But it's a great way to connect.
Right, for sure. They want to talk on the mic too, Renee.
This one has a question.
We got a big bee in here. Interesting. That's good. You got any more questions? You good?
I'm good.
Okay, cool.
Thank you.
Dope, man. Thank you for coming hang out
with
us.
That's it? Oh, my God. That's so much fun.
Yeah, man. It's pretty simple. Went by quick. It's already like an hour and a half with Zoom. See, isn't it? It's not
that's
bad.
That's awesome. Thank you for having me.
Indeed. Thank you for hanging out with us, Renee.
Absolutely. Thank you. I love hearing your story. It's an excellent story.
Indeed. Yeah. Y'all could probably, you know, swap information, too, since you guys are doing the same, similar things. You know, he's a younger, you know, exec out there trying to kill the game. You know, doing some. Tell them about what you got over there. What you're doing over there at BET Plus.
Oh yes. So, as you know, the industry is chaotic, but we're still looking. We're making movies. Still looking for content. We're in the smaller budgeted range of films, and we have to keep the engine running for BET Plus. Try to keep subscribers as long as possible. 40, 35 films every other Thursday, practically once a week, so subscribers can stay on the platform.
Wow.
So we work with lots of production companies. We're always looking for new talent. Seems like you got a bevy of them.
We should definitely talk. I mean, hey, a place that's making movies, let's do it.
Yes.
You actually want to make things. That is great news. That's great news.
And it's tough with the risk averse. It's so hard with SAG actors increasing its prices but the studios decreasing their budgets.
Yep.
And that's really, really tough. That's the most notable difference I've seen after the strike. Can I make a comment to one of his questions about an older writer? So one thing that the big networks and studios love, they love the 40 to 70 year old demographic. They love their buying power and how loyal they are in keeping their subscriptions. Mm. So they make lots of content for that group. They want to make it for that group. And even BT Plus has an older demographic. So a particular case, I won't name names. We've had a writer that was focused, that was doing a story on an older character in his 40s, 50s. And this younger writer essentially wasn't landing it. We got an older writer to come in, do brush ups, wasn't as experienced per se in his IMDb, but he really landed it. Mm. So for all the older writers listening in, know that you just have comfort knowing that these networks and big studios love the purchasing power of that demographic, and you they know that money. Voice. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas folks my age are way more fickle. Oh, so, I'm going to binge this free trial and leave. Right. Yeah, but not with that demographic. So if you are of that
more
age,
loyal, yeah, than correct. All that. Right, right.
If you are that age and you know that voice, that's going to speak volumes to that demographic that the network loves.
That's dope. What do you think about that?
Say what?
What do you think about that?
Oh, yeah. I think it's... I was going to add, I think for older writers, mm-hmm. you know, the script, the actual scripts that you're writing, it's really paramount, you know. So I think writing features, mm-hmm. where the goal is just getting a great script, right? They don't care about... They don't care about hiring you for your next movie, right. mm-hmm. in a way that in television they have to hire you for 100 episodes, mm-hmm. right? So I think writing a screenplay is a way to do it. Books, like, obviously authors can be of any age, and, you know, people just, they just care about the writing, the quality of the book. So yeah. I think film and publishing are more open to older writers and accepting. I think the hierarchical nature of television lends itself to, you know, keeping things younger, but again, there you have to just lean into your advantages and your life experiences to distinguish yourself.
Agreed. Yeah. So, well, thank you, everybody. Appreciate everybody for hanging out. Renee, where can people follow you? Where are you at?
You can find me on LinkedIn, Renee Rodriguez, little hyphen Lopez, got two last names. You can also email me, renee.rodriguez@paramount.com. And then my personal email is reneeinstant@gmail.com. reneeinstant@gmail.com.
That's just it. And then my man, Zadok Angel, in the building. Where can people follow you?
I am blessed with a very unique name.
So where did you get it? What
if
is
you
it?
Just search, I'm going to pop
That's
up.
True. That's true.
You know, I'm on Instagram @ZadokAngel. Right. You know, it's just so easy for me to get my name. So, yeah, I'm very accessible, and you can definitely find me.
Right. He's got a beautiful picture of the beautiful kids and the hubby.
I have 6-year-old twins, yeah, Connor and Catherine. They're in kindergarten, Spanish immersion kindergarten. They're doing great. It's fun being a parent, right. And all the ups and downs of that. But that's been a big shift in my life. I went from being, you know, Mr. Career obsessed, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. focused, to having to, you know, open up my life to children and family, yeah. in a big way. And it's just been a wonderful thing, and yeah. helped balance my life out. And I think it's really important. And I highly recommend it to creative people.
Well, every time I see the photos, y'all look happy. So that's the key.
Well, my husband makes me laugh a lot, yeah. so Sean is humor, and we all need humor in our lives.
Indeed.
And we have a really great family. I'm lucky.
Awesome. Well, thank you again. Appreciate you hanging out with us. Thank you, Rich. Thank you, Tyler, for joining us. Everybody joining with us when I get to it for Game All Day. I'm Hilliard Guest. You guys can find me at Hilliard Guest everywhere. I also just started Screenwriters Rant Room on Instagram, finally. Shut up. And but we're everywhere. New website coming, everything. I just flew in the other day from, I haven't told you, Renee. I just flew in from Provincetown. I was in scouting for this new movie I'm shooting in September. And I came back and I'm like, I can't think straight. Like, I'm like, got jet lag or something. I don't know. I've never had it before, but I just have been off. Just been like, duh, what's this? Anyway.
So Hilliard on an off day is,
yeah,
like,
this is, I'm bad.
Most today. People at full speed.
Yeah, I feel like I had like 2 hours of sleep today. Please go on iTunes, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys listen to. Please give us a 5-star review. We need that for the metrics. Please follow the show, share it, retweet it, all that stuff. Let me see what else. So much good shit going on. Website coming. I mentioned that. We're going to be having t-shirts, hoodies, finally doing it big time. I'm talking with Dances with Films Film Festival about doing another big podcast live at their festival this year in Hollywood. So that'll be huge. Lots of shit going on. And we start production next week. Bam. So, yeah, we're moving and grooving. So, thank you again, Zadok, Renee, Rich, Tyler. Thank you, guys. Everybody joining me. You guys know how we do it on the Rant Room. On the show, we keep it real. We keep it opinionated. We keep it what, everybody? Game all day. Peace, y'all.
I'ma say what I feel. And I promise to keep it real.
Welcome to the Rant Room.
So you wanna be a rider, well you gotta be a rider till your fears are diminishing, the doubts are behind ya. It's hard to grind and the business got me stressed. In the Rant Room, we let that shit up off our chest. You never have to guess when you're listening to Hilliard. He gon' bring more game than a shark playing billiards. It's all about the craft of screenwriting. It's exciting when you turn an outline into something enlightening. Your pen and words are like bullets in a gun. Write what you feel, say what you want.
Welcome to the Rant Room.